might have seen the point, counterpoint, pro and con columns that appeared in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch a couple days ago on abortion and, well, regarding the St. Louis Archbishop Raymond Burke's statement on voting and abortion. We're going to be talking about that in the first 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. One of the columnists there, Father Edward Richard, will be our guest. He's from Kenrick Glennon Seminary here in St. Louis. We're going to be talking about some of the response that the counterpoint made there. Has the church's position on abortion been ambiguous, undecided? Has there been something, well, what the columnist calls balance on the issue of abortion throughout history? And what does that mean today, if so? We're going to talk about that in the first 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. Today, I'm Todd Wilkin. Feel free to join us during the next 3 hours at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. To round off the first hour, Matt Staver of the Liberty Council will join us to talk about same-sex marriage. He's authored a new book called Same-Sex Marriage, Putting Every Household at Risk. We're going to talk about some of the issues, both public and moral, that surround the whole controversy of same-sex marriage, and try and focus on its effect and potential effect on children. Because, of course, I was recently up in the Chicago area speaking on the issue of same-sex marriage, and felt the need to point out several times, and this was one of the greatest concerns expressed by the pastors I was speaking to, what comes after same-sex marriage? Let's say the debate runs its course, and for the sake of argument, same-sex marriage becomes legalized on a greater scale than it already is in the United States. Well, what's next? Well, it seems obvious what's next. The nationwide acceptance of adopting children into same-sex marriages. The same-sex family. After the same-sex marriage comes the same-sex family. So we'll be talking about that with Matt Staver in about 25 minutes. In the third hour, and running into the second hour, we're going to have a lot of audio for you to react to. We're going to be hearing from people on both the right and the left, both politicians and religious figures, waxing eloquent on what the Bible has to say about how we ought to do our politics, our foreign policy. We'll hear from Senator John Kerry. He was quoting scripture again. He has a couple scripture verses that he likes to quote a lot. One of them is faith without works is dead, and he has a particular affinity for the parable of the Good Samaritan. We'll be hearing from him. Also, Pastor William Shaw, president of the National Baptist Convention, and Boston Archbishop Sean O'Malley. Also, the Reverend Pat Robertson will be in there as well. Now, sometime in that 90 minutes of open lines or into the third hour of the program, we will be playing for you an entire segment of Sunday night's Dateline program, where there was a rather extensive interview with Rick Warren, author of the book, The Purpose-Driven Life. I think very telling. We're going to play it in its entirety and start and stop occasionally for my reaction. I'd like your reaction as well. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Also in the third hour, Brad Miner will join us, author of the book, The Complete Gentleman, A Modern Man's Guide to Chivalry. We're going to be talking about chivalry and the presidential candidates. That's the lineup for today on Issues, Etc. Father Edward Richard is our guest. He's a lawyer and professor of moral theology at Kenrick Glennon Seminary here in St. Louis, author of a column in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch titled Abortion's Equation with Evil is Old Tenant. And Father Richard also is the designated spokesman for St. Louis Archbishop Raymond Burke on the issue of voting and abortion. Father Richard, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Why, thank you, Todd. It's a privilege to be with you again.
First of all, if you would, respond to an accusation that's made in the counterpoint column to yours in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and has been made several times in the media, that Archbishop Raymond Burke is kind of wandering around on this issue, coming out hard at first and then backtracking.
Well, I think the problem is that you have to look at the context of all the statements that he was making and the clarifications that he tried to make, and there are just different circumstances in which that might apply, in which one might say, for example, yes, to vote for a pro-abortion politician is sinful, and there are circumstances when it might not be. And so, obviously, we're not going to get all of those kinds of clarifications laid out necessarily in the media. On the other hand, I have to say that it's been my experience of working in these last few days with them that people have worked assiduously to try to understand what he said since the pastor letter came out.
What is the essence of Archbishop Raymond Burke and other bishops' pronouncements on this issue?
The essence of it is this. Number one, in our voting, we have a responsibility for the common good, and we should seek to do as much good as possible and to minimize the evils in society. On that score, there are some fundamental issues that are like prerequisites or precursors to just all of a host of social issues that are on the contemporary scene. Those life issues that were mentioned in the pastoral letter, abortion, euthanasia, cloning, embryonic stem cell research, and the fundamental question about the sanctity of marriage and same-sex marriage. And then, after that, after you talk about the voters' responsibility to do that, then there's another question about whether or not somehow or another we could be cooperating in another person's sin, the other person being the politician in this case who advocates these openly immoral actions and is very permissive about them. If I, in my choice of voting, somehow support them in doing that, under what conditions am I involved in their sin? And then what does a voter do when there's no perfect candidate out there? And again, it goes back to the question of trying to minimize evil as much as possible.
How do you respond to the charge that's made, often has been made quite a bit lately, that what the bishop has done, what the archbishop has done here, is crossing the line of the separation of church and state?
Well, that's a complicated legal constitutional question, and it also, well, let me just put it this way, just on a general scale. What I find is that most people that say that are not speaking from a either doctrinal or legal point of view constitutionally. They just have this vague notion about separation of church and state, so they don't really understand necessarily the legal or moral doctrine, or if you will, even a religious doctrine that might be involved in that point of view. The Constitution says that Congress will make no law respecting the establishment of a religion or restricting the free exercise thereof. We consider this to be a free exercise of religion that is consistent with each Christian's role, and obviously every people have different views of that too, but just from a general perspective about what is a Christian's role as a citizen and what is a Christian's role as a voter.
Frank Flynn, who's adjunct professor of religious studies at Washington University here in St. Louis, wrote the counterpoint to your column in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He said that Catholic teaching on abortion in particular has never been unanimous. Is this true?
Well, there have always been discussions, or there were discussions, of course, about some questions pertaining to the actual meaning of abortion or what was being done. But abortion has always been considered a grave sin. The question that he was addressing is how theologically some of these theologians, and very respected ones indeed, even popes, talked about the issue. Was it equivalent with murder, as in killing a person deliberately, or was it something else? Obviously, in the very early days and early centuries of the church, the question about the biology was not as clear as it is today. We didn't know anything about genetics then and the genetic potential of the human embryo. So there were discussions along that area, but under no circumstances were there any doctrine that said it's morally acceptable to directly kill a fetus, a human fetus.
Flynn has also written, the church has always allowed Catholic politicians the autonomy to seek compromises, such as laws that restrict only some abortions or laws that address the conditions that give rise to abortion. Is there anything in Archbishop Burke's statements that would contradict this?
Not that I could see from I would say no, because obviously, you know, to allow for appropriate and I mean respectful legislation that allows for the abortion as a side effect of a treatment or something is certainly perfectly acceptable, and politicians should have that leeway, and the Archbishop doesn't contradict that.
You have written about very, very ancient teachings regarding abortion. I think it may strike some of our listeners as odd that abortion would have been a reality addressed by the early church all the way back to 70 A.D. in a writing called the Didache. Tell us about this.
Well, the whole history of this goes all the way back to, as you say, some of our earliest writings that talks about the practice in the early church, and we clearly see an expression of against abortion even that early. So, I mean, and as far as that goes, again, it's an unbroken teaching in terms of the presentations that go along with that through the centuries. There aren't any real any departures from that. There are discussions, as I said earlier, about what, you know, when is the its soul infused in the body and so forth, but they were going on particular philosophical principles or so forth and trying to settle these things. But doctrinally, that's pretty much been settled in favor of the presumption that a human embryo must be treated with the respect due a person.
What about the charge, and this is also made by Frank Flynn in his column, that the New Testament says nothing about abortion per se, and I think the implication is, therefore, the church is really on shaky ground if it wants to make any definitive pronouncements.
Well, I suppose, you know, that's a, and I would certainly welcome your input on this too, Todd, but it's not something that I would call myself, you know, having explored this completely in the context of this whole debate. But here's my take on the thing. Clearly, we have prohibition against murder that goes way back into the Old Testament, and Jesus' teaching in the New Testament does not do away with these very important moral laws. In fact, as you know, in the Sermon on the Mount, he brings out their fullest meaning, and the whole positive side of the commandments of doing things to support life and so forth. Plus, there are also, in the New Testament, you see other teachings that would surround the idea of, you know, protecting life, of not giving potions and magical things or doing magical things to somehow interfere with I would say, procreation. So that would be, you know, probably the best answer I could give you at this point.
Catholic politicians, along with other politicians of other confessions of faith, routinely run afoul of their various churches and denominations on issues. Why is the issue of life and abortion of particular concern to Archbishop Burke?
Well, these issues are considered by in the teaching of the church, and one could look this up in the Catechism, for example. We think that, first of all, going from God's gift of life, that human beings are made in the image and likeness of God, and that he has chosen to bring these new images of life into the world, in and through us human persons and our bodies, that you can't deny the sacredness of that, and consequently for any civil society, the very foundation of our society has to be built upon the protection of innocent life as just a fundamental and indispensable tenet of society.
On the issue of Roe v. Wade, which seems to be kind of the legal nexus here, you have written that the rationale in the Roe decision did not deny that the unborn child is human. Explain that.
Well, there's nothing in Roe v. Wade that would say that, you know, the unborn child is not human. What the court seemed to do was simply to say, this is a philosophical, theological question. We don't have the answer to it. Different people disagree. If we look at the law, the law is sort of ambiguous on this. So, you know, we just don't decide it.
So the court was not speaking to the issue of the unborn, per se. They were simply asserting the woman's rights over the unborn.
Right, and that's why they came up with the trimester rules with respect to different rights. At a certain point, the state was allowed to step in for health reasons or so forth, but even in the third trimester in Doe versus Bolton, the court would allow the woman to make that decision and with her doctor, or if a doctor certified that this was for psychological reasons. So they just sidestepped the issue, leaving it as a matter of privacy. But again, as I point out in the column, how could we even begin to say that that's a private decision as much you know, the voices in society and so forth that are promoting this, and it's such a public debate.
We're talking about St. Louis Archbishop Raymond Burke's statement on voting and abortion with Father Edward Richard. He's a lawyer and professor of moral theology at Kenrick Glennon Seminary here in St. Louis. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Father Richard, you have also written about the court's new morality. What is that?
Well, the court's new morality really is something that was crystallized in the middle of the last century. And basically, it was utilitarian and pragmatic. The courts, by the beginning of the last century, that is the 20th century, had moved away from this whole view of life that the cosmos, that God had created the world and had placed his wisdom in the world, and that we were bound by certain laws that were manifested by his wisdom and in the whole scope of creation. By the middle of the last century, under the influence of people like Roscoe Pound from Harvard Law School and Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was a member of the U.S. Supreme Court, they had begun to formulate a new legal theory that excluded God completely from the picture, saying that we didn't need any kind of recourse to the Creator or God in order to have our laws, because what they wanted to do was to transform the law and the judiciary into a means of social engineering. And they said that. I'm not putting words in their mouth. Roscoe Pound said those words exactly. And they did that on the basis of the pragmatic morality of William James and John Dewey.
And what about a Catholic voter who would say, look, I think I have a way that I can go about doing this, and you address this in your column. What I'm going to do is I'm going to vote for a candidate that has a permissive stance on abortion and other life issues, but that's done in the hope that someday, some way, the overall evil that's done there as a result by the candidate will be less than the direct attacks on life.
Mm-hmm.
Does this work? Is this good moral reasoning for a Catholic voter?
Absolutely not. To say somehow or another that I'm going to be involved in the direct promotion of some evil for which there can be no justification as a means of bringing about sometime in the future a greater good is completely contrary to biblical teaching, as I said, that prohibits doing evil in order that good may come of it.
One of the other concerns that came out of the Archbishop's statements, and there have been three main statements, is I think a barrier that exists between the language of moral theology that mm-hmm. the Archbishop is obviously very comfortable with
mm-hmm.
and he feels it's the most precise way to mm-hmm. lay out his position, mm-hmm. and the inability, not necessarily unwillingness, but the inability of the popular media mm-hmm. to translate that language into something that the average citizen can understand.
Yeah, it's very difficult, but as I said earlier, I'm grateful that they've really tried. It's just that, I think what I would try to emphasize out of all of that is that if each person reflects in their own conscience on, first of all, be aware that this is primarily, the big issue is abortion. We're talking about in terms of the gravity of the evil in society, the numbers are phenomenal. And as we continue to allow this permissiveness, it's going to cause many more social evils. Okay, people have got to understand how serious the Catholic Church as well as other Christians are about the meaning of the human person, the meaning of human life, and this issue of abortion. It is an important issue. If they could just imagine themselves as human embryos or whatever, I don't know what it's going to take. We react so vehemently and so strongly when we see some particular group of people being killed in other parts of the world or in other times in history, and yet we think, oh, well, that has nothing to do with where we are today. It has everything to do with where we are today. And if they could just appropriate that and then understand then that we have a responsibility, the bottom line is to go out and minimize that in our society. As Christians who believe in the sanctity of life, if we are united on that, we can do something about it. And I think that's another very important follow-up point, that these issues, you know, people can say, oh, well, what about this issue? What about health care? What about, well, none of those things mean anything without life. And if we want to do something about those other things, which I certainly say let's be as just as we can, we want to get rid of all of those injustices and discrimination, but we can't allow the fact that we can't do it all at once to prohibit us from doing the most important things that need to be done.
Finally, was the Archbishop requiring Catholics in his diocese to vote Republican?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. He's asking them to examine their consciences according to these issues. You know, whether you talk about Catholics, whether you talk about Christians in general or whatever, let's just assume that, I mean, I shouldn't make that kind of assumption, but I think there are a lot of Christians who respect life. These principles about life, about promoting human dignity, about the sacredness of marriage, have been there a long time before Republicans, Democrats, whatever party you want. The fact that we raise those issues again for the future now, either in upcoming elections for the next few years, has nothing to do with the fact that there are some out there who accept it and some who don't. In fact, I know myself, many good Democrats and Republicans who support these things. And the Archbishop was very clear to me that he's not satisfied with either of these at this point, but still the obligation is there for us to try to minimize the evils in the best way we can.
Father Edward Richard is a lawyer, a professor of moral theology at Kenrick Glennon Seminary here in St. Louis, author of a column in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch titled Abortion's Equation with Evil is Old Tenon. And he is also a designated spokesman for St. Louis Archbishop Raymond Burke on the issue of voting and abortion. Thank you for being our guest, Father Richard.
Thank you, Todd. It's been a pleasure.
When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with Matt Staver about same-sex marriage, focusing for the next 25 minutes on the effect that it has on children. We'll talk more about that when we come back.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most talk radio shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you to pay the production salaries and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to prayerfully consider making a financial gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You can donate by credit card, 1-800-737-0172. Or you can donate by check, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend upon you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc.
Now this Global Minute lets you hear the inspiring story of a boy named Prem Dass who escaped a kerosene lamp fire in his blanket, the heartache of his mother running away from home, and a tiger that almost attacked him. His story takes place in India. Prem Dass also suffered from malnutrition and a variety of emotional traumas. But at age 6, he found a home with Ramabai Mukti Mission where house parents encouraged him in academics and prayed for him. At age 14, Prem Dass is a top Bible student and has trusted Christ as his personal Savior. On holidays, Prem Dass and the other children return home to their villages in India, where people see the positive changes Christ has made in their lives. Pray for the Mukti Children's Homes in India. See Mukti's work in India on a DVD and video titled India's Buds and Blossoms. Get a free copy by calling 1-800-268-0461. That's 800-268-0461.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Last week, the House of Representatives in Washington passed House Resolution 761, congratulating Lance Armstrong for his victory in the 2004 Tour de France. No question about it, he certainly deserves the praise. That said, sincerely, I'm still haunted by a passage from his latest book. Armstrong wrote, "At the end of the day, we were like everybody else. The kids were tired and hungry, and the adults were too. I would walk through the door, physically spent. Keek, his wife, would be worn out from a day with three small children under the age of 3. Neither of us wanted to admit problems or fatigue. Neither one of us was able to say to the other, 'This doesn't feel quite right.' So we simply drifted on, doing our best." Now, it's not my business to peer into that marriage, which ended in divorce. As a minister, I have talked with couples who didn't realize how critical is the way you handle that time when you come home, tired and weary. That's the time when you are tempted to crash by yourself, but it's really the time to emotionally listen to and support your spouse. You may win the race at work, but is it worth it if you grow apart from the one you love?
The Missouri Historical Society invites you to a free jazz concert Sunday, October 10th at 2 p.m. at the Missouri History Museum, Lindell and DeBolivar in Forest Park. Spend the afternoon with the Tom Byrne Jazz Ensemble as they perform jazz classics as well as original compositions written by Byrne. Byrne has been a mainstay on the St. Louis jazz scene for over 20 years. It's happening Sunday, October 10th at the Missouri History Museum in Forest Park.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Matt Staver will join us here in just a moment. We're going to talk about same-sex marriage. On a lighter note, for those of you who haven't been able to follow what's going on downtown, the Cardinals did beat the Dodgers 8-3 in Game 1 of the National League Division Series. So we should say at this point, go Cards. I was going to wear my hat tonight. This afternoon, I got a brand new, one of those retro Cardinals hats that they're selling all over the place. And it was really an attractive thing, and I forgot to put it on, walked out the door. Lo and behold, I'm missing my new Cardinals hat on a day like this. Matt Staver will join us for the next 25 minutes. Then in the second hour of the program, we're going to be hearing all sorts of audio from John Kerry and others, quoting scripture and people of the cloth, among them the Reverend Pat Robertson, telling us how we ought to conduct our foreign policy according to Holy Scripture. We're going to be talking about same-sex marriage here with Matt Staver. He's president and general counsel of the Liberty Council, and he's author of a new book, Same-Sex Marriage, Putting Every Household at Risk. We're going to focus in this 25 minutes on the effect and the potential effect of same-sex marriage on the family and on children. Matt Staver, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you.
Why shouldn't two people who love each other and are committed to each other, but happen to be of the same sex, why shouldn't they be allowed to marry?
Well, no one is allowed to marry any kind of person or groups of people they want to. For example, fathers can't marry their daughters, nor can mothers marry their sons. You can't marry certain people of a certain relationship, and there are certain age restrictions on marriage as well. You can't marry two people two other individuals. In other words, you can't have polygamy. You can't have polyamory where you have group marriage. So marriage has never been a free-for-all, nor should it. The reason why is because marriage is more than just simply a private, personal emotion between two people or even more people if someone wants to open up to polygamy. It is, in fact, a public good. It's a public institution. The reason is because marriage affects children, and marriage affects children and society. And there is a real basic reason why we've promoted marriage as one man and one woman, and that is not only for procreation, for the continuation of our generation, but also for the well-being of our generation. Children do best when they're raised with moms and dads. Over 10,000 studies indicate that that, in fact, is the case. It is indisputable within the social science research.
Okay, connect the dots, if you would, on the issue of same-sex marriage and both the real and potential harm to children.
Well, children do best with their moms and dads. For example, boys need dual-gender households, and so do girls. And, in fact, boys after the ages of 18 to 36 months, they begin to realize and recognize that they're different from mom and they're more like dad. And consequently, they begin to shift their bonding from mom to dad. And it's during those early developmental years where the boy develops into the male concept, the maleness. It's called gender identity development. Girls do something similar but a little bit dissimilar to boys. But the point is that both of them need moms and dads. And in fact, for example, girls that are raised in lesbian households where you have two moms are much more likely, according to the research, to engage in sexual activity earlier on in adolescence and more frequently than girls that are raised with a mom and a dad. What is very clear is that when you absolutely mess around with the fundamental basic family unit, you ultimately damage children and you affect society. So it does make a difference what society promotes. Same-sex marriage, if you were to go down that road, would damage children and hurt society. And one of the things that we've always done with marriage is we've promoted it, we've preserved it, we've put laws around it to strengthen it because it is the basic foundation and bedrock of our society. Same-sex marriage would say, let's put on that same preferred platform same-sex relationships. Well, same-sex relationships would damage society, damage children. We don't need to experiment or hypothesize how this happens. We can see how it's happened, for example, in the Scandinavian countries, in Norway, Denmark, and Sweden, where same-sex unions have destabilized the marriage institution itself. And in 1999, when the Netherlands adopted full-blown same-sex marriage, the research coming out of there is the same thing. It has actually undermined and destabilized the entire marriage institution. So we don't need to experiment or hypothesize. We know what's happened around the country. We don't want to experiment with our children.
We have spoken at length on this subject with Greg Kokel of Stand to Reason. He has argued, I think rather convincingly, that this is not a simple issue of simply redefining the term marriage or even the institution of marriage. Along with marriage then comes the institution of the parent or parenthood. The family, we're not just talking about same-sex marriage, we're talking about same-sex parents, same-sex families,
right.
And in addition, it changes the foundations of society.
It really does. Once you say, as a policy, same-sex marriage would create a policy, and everything else would revolve around that. We're not talking about two people just simply having emotions toward one another and doing whatever they want to do in their privacy. We're talking about taking this, so to speak, out into the public, not just out into the public, but creating a policy, putting it as a preferred and desirable and ideal relationship toward whom and toward which we should all achieve and toward which we should aspire. Once you do that, which we've always done with marriage, and for good reasons, without it, we would absolutely come to an end. We would not only come to an end, but the children and the society we would create would be damaging. If we were to put same-sex marriage on that same preferred, aspirable platform, all of our social policies around it would converge and be focused on that. And what I mean by that is education, for example. In our educational system, children would be affirmatively taught, as they are even in some schools right now, to engage in same-sex behavior. GLSEN, the organization, and PFLAG, another organization, is very successful in getting curriculum into public schools. Even now, pre-same-sex marriage, where they're encouraging boys as young as 5 years old in kindergarten to experiment with same-sex activity, saying that you need to find your gender identity, and you best ought to do that with same-sex relationships at an early age. You also have the issues of employment, all the different kinds of benefits and the practices that would come along with that. Same-sex marriage is, in fact, the abolition of gender. And it would have a ripple effect in any of our gender-based institutions. For example, if you go to Wesleyan University right now, gender is on the verge of being abolished there. If you apply for housing, for example, on their application form, they no longer ask you if you're male or female. They ask you for your gender identity history. And so you put in there, what is your gender identity history? Well, I'm male, but I want to express myself as female. Okay, then you'll go into the female dorms. That is actually happening in America. It is happening as part of a trend in same-sex unions around the world, because one of the things that same-sex marriage does is it comes to a decidedly, and for a good reason, gender-based institution and says that gender is no longer relevant to that institution. That has a ripple effect as a policy matter in every other gender-based institution or category that we operate in. But additionally, it would also have a direct effect on freedom of speech. For example, even in this country, you used to say, well, around the world it was happening, but now it's happening in this country. In Colorado, a woman who is now a Christian was in a lesbian relationship, became a Christian, and left the relationship. She has a daughter of her own. The other lesbian filed suit claiming that she wanted custody and visitation of this other woman's child. The court not only granted her that, but also told the Christian mom that she could no longer expose her child to any religious teaching or instruction that some might be considered to be homophobic. So the reason why that order was entered is because she attends a church, and in the church is a literature rack, and on the rack is pro-family literature from Promise Keepers. So we're seeing the impact that it has on freedom of expression, and it would have a policy impact on everything we do.
We use the term, and we could hardly avoid using it because it is the parlance of today, the term gender. But does the shift from talking about one's sex to one's gender, is that in itself a bit of a compromise, at least in terms of our language, on this whole issue?
It is, and here's what I do. I'm finishing a law review article for publication on transsexual situations in a case that we defended against transsexual marriage. Transsexualism is another attempt to abolish the idea of gender or sex. If you look at the homosexual and same-sex marriage and transsexual movements, they try to make a distinction between gender and sex, thinking that sex is your physical manifestation, whereas gender is your inner manifestation of male or female. And so they're talking about gender identity, which means essentially that on the outward you can be male or female in terms of your sex, but on the inside you can be the opposite in terms of your gender expression. Now, literally, there's no difference between gender and sex, but they've tried to make a dichotomy. And so in their literature, they're talking about the notion of gender being something in your mind and sex being something in your physiology and biology. Of course, they are the same. But one of the things that you're seeing is this. In fact, you see it in some of the statutory developments where they come in with sexual orientation policies. Now what they are doing is coming behind those policies once they're adopted and wanting to amend them to add words such as gender expression so that people are protected with all of the kinds of manifestations they want to manifest. The reason is this. They say, and a court order actually said this, a case that we've been working on, and so far we've gotten overturned, but it's in their literature, it's in their movement, and this is how they express it. They say, for example, gender is an outdated concept, and it ought to be abolished. The reason is because they say it's stereotypic, that males typically act sexually in a certain way, females typically act sexually in another way. If you abolish the male-female notion, binary sex is what it is. If you abolish that, then you've abolished all restrictions on human sexuality. So consequently, their movement in the same-sex marriage movement is designed to legally protect any kind of human sexual expression, no matter what place along the spectrum and how many times throughout that spectrum you shift your activity, they want legal protection for that. That is nothing less than the abolition of all objective law. It would ultimately result in chaos. And same-sex marriage is the tip of the spear toward the movement to abolish the notion of male and female.
So the arguments, both legal, philosophical, that are being made or mounted against for same-sex marriage are being designed in order to argue for things other than same-sex marriage, in fact, to broaden the definition of marriage as far as one would any individual be willing to take it.
There's no question about that. In fact, the American Civil Liberties Union is one of several groups that are strongly promoting same-sex marriage. They also believe that same-sex marriage should lead to the legalization of polygamy, where you have multiple wives or multiple husbands. And they also believe that same-sex marriage, once achieved, should also open the door to polyamory. Polyamory is group marriage, so you could have two men and two women marrying, or five men and 10 women. You just have a commune, and they all get married together, and that commune of group people then receive a joint marriage license. That's polyamory. And that's what these groups are promoting. And once you go across this boundary, and you say to a gender-based institution, a sex-based institution, male and female, once you cross that line and say, for purposes of marriage, we are going to set a policy, we're going to license the activity, we're going to put laws around it to protect it and promote it, you have abolished the concept of gender already. And once you've done that, you open the door to polygamy. Somebody can come to you right after they say, well, gee, I'm just two men and I want to have my expression toward one another. You ought to license it. And so if the state does that, the next person comes along and says, well, gee, I'm two men, but we also both like the same woman. Well, legally, once you've crossed that boundary and you have abolished the marriage institution by giving it union, by giving it legitimacy of same-sex unions, you cannot legally, rationally, or logically stop any other kind of licensing. Polygamy would be next. Polyamory would be next. Then what you would ultimately end up doing is abolishing the whole concept of marriage, because marriage would no longer be a unique institution. It would no longer have any unique meaning, and consequently, as we've seen in the Scandinavian countries and the Netherlands, people just stop getting married. They have all different kinds of relationships. Some of them are licensed, some of them are not, but the institution of the family begins to break down and deteriorate.
I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc. Our guest, Matt Staver, President and General Counsel of Liberty Counsel, author of the new book, Same-Sex Marriage, Putting Every Household at Risk. Matt, one thing that I found rather blood-chilling was to read recently from Andrew Sullivan, a leading advocate for same-sex marriage and a nationally syndicated columnist, where he wrote in a book, this was actually written about 3-4 years ago, the book itself, that the intention for same-sex marriage is quite different than what heterosexual marriage is ideally. When usually in the public debate, we're assuming that we're talking about a stable, monogamous, lifelong relationship, but Sullivan says, no, 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 that's not how homosexual dynamics work, and that's not how same-sex marriage would work either. It would be an open relationship.
That's right. An open relationship within the homosexual community, particularly male homosexuals, has taken on an interesting meaning. And an open relationship is where you have two men living together and they have non-monogamy agreements, which most such arrangements have these kinds of agreements. The non-monogamy arrangement would be essentially we'll share the same home, but we'll have partners outside of this home frequently and often. In fact, if you look at male homosexuality, it is extremely promiscuous. It is part and parcel of understanding the whole gender identity development. The gender identity development situation that male homosexuals go through is essentially having in their developmental phase some kind of difficulty that they face in relating to the same sex. They ultimately begin to shy away from that sex, eventually idolize that same sex, and then get that maleness which they lack filled by having male-male relationships. Male-male relationships then become very promiscuous. It's very well known. And in the homosexual community, it's very frequently talked about as an open relationship. The same-sex marriage movement wants marriage not for what it stands for in its essence, a lifelong monogamous commitment where a man and woman invest themselves to one another, sexually to one another, and invest their lives in children. No, it is symbolic. It is to break through a status, not to have the essence of what marriage stands for, but in the process to gain the status and to abolish and rewrite the entire notion of marriage. In fact, if you go to Canada, a recent poll just a few months ago says that many of the homosexuals that were surveyed there, even though in some provinces now they can get married, and I use that around quotes, but some provinces they can, even though they can, they don't want to get married for the purpose of marriage, but they want to get a license in order to abolish the actual institution itself.
This raises a question, and this was raised by another guest of ours, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. He says, look, he's a human rights lawyer. He says that same-sex couples can have everything they claim they want out of the institution of marriage through other legal contractual means. They can have visitation rights, common
right.
property, all of these things. Why then do homosexuals want same-sex marriage?
They want it as a policy tool to gain acceptance and to gain power. And then they don't want it just for the benefits that marriage gives, because you're right. For visitation and hospitalization cases, for disposition of property, whatever it is, they can personally enter into contractual relationships with one another and gain virtually all the legal rights and protections that people would have by virtue of having a marriage license. So the question is, if they can have all of those, then why do they want the piece of paper? They want the piece of paper because it elevates them to a status from which they can now dismantle the institution, and they can also use that as a billy club to bring the rest of unwilling society into compliance with their lifestyle. That's what they want. That's where the agenda is going. It's not an agenda of tolerance. It's one of intolerance. Its agenda is focused on dominating any opposing viewpoint. We've seen that happen in America. We've seen that happen in 1998. Where San Francisco literally passed a resolution that says anyone who says that homosexuality is wrong or is a choice, that very message is hate speech, which leads to hate crimes that ought to be punishable. Well, guess who was one of the people on that board that passed it? It was Mayor Gavin Newsom, who's the mayor of San Francisco, that intentionally broke the law this year. It's an individual that Liberty Council filed suit against and stopped him from issuing these licenses, but that is unmasking the agenda. It is aggressive. It is in your face. It will not stop until it achieves its goal. That's why in America, I think, here's what we face. We face a historic moment in history. I believe that the same-sex marriage movement and the homosexual agenda pushed too fast, too quickly. And as a result, in the last 12 to 18 months, the majority of Americans are being fed up with that. And they're being awakened to the realities of what's coming. That's why I think you're seeing so many people now saying no to same-sex marriage and yes to traditional marriage. I think what we're seeing is an awakening of people and churches and pastors, people who are even apolitical, a-religious, but they're saying enough is enough. Marriage is simple, common sense. It's for one man and one woman.
Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Diane calls from St. Louis. Diane, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hello. Thank you for your program. I think there are a lot of aggressive people in the homosexual movement that do want to fight for rights, but I think there's a lot of them kind of on the sidelines that want the marriage license to appease their guilty conscience.
Diane, yes. Thank you for the call.
Mm-hmm.
Diane, I think you're right, and I think there are some when a lot of people equate morality with legality. If it's legal, it must be moral. Well, you know, there's a lot of things that are legal, but they are immoral. And so Diane is exactly right. Some people want the license because if you have a license, how can anyone argue against it? And in fact, within the homosexual agenda literature, one of the things that they want to do in long-term goals is to equate anyone who says homosexuality is wrong or is a choice in the same category as one who would be a KKK speaking against an African-American or a Jewish person. They want to vilify you, and so that whenever you say it's a choice or it's wrong, you are automatically vilified, and consequently your speech and actions are criminalized, so that their lifestyle would in fact be legitimate, and the law would be used as a billy club to bring in line your views.
Frank is calling from Chesterfield. Frank, our time is short. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering if in the broad evangelical church, because of the de-emphasis on ordinances like the Ten Commandments and therefore the decriminalization of our traditional civil codes on adultery, fornication, sodomy, and so forth, that if this isn't the basic fundamental reason for why we see the attack on marriage, it's my view that we flail against the marriage issue, ignoring the fundamental ordinances of God that have been neglected by the church and therefore by the culture generally.
Frank, thank you. Matt, we've got about 30 seconds for that answer.
Frank, I think a lot of what you say is very true. We didn't get to this place of same-sex marriage discussion overnight. It was a progression. I think, however, in bringing up this issue, it makes us revisit our moral codes. It makes us revisit why we have neglected the institution of marriage. It makes us revisit why many people in churches are having the same divorce rates as those who are non-church. All of those need to be revisited. I think we will defeat the same-sex marriage movement, but I think in the process we will reclaim and restore the institution of marriage, because these issues are fundamental to how we got here, and we need to go back and revisit and undergird these very issues that you brought up.
Matt, I hope you're right on that last bite. I sincerely hope and pray that you are right. Thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Matt Staver is president and general counsel of Liberty Counsel. He's author of the new book, Same-Sex Marriage, Putting Every Household at Risk. The website address for Liberty Counsel is www.lc.org. That's lc.org. That's the website of Liberty Counsel. When we come back from this break, we're going to hear from Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry speaking again this last Sunday at a church in Cleveland. Now everyone knows that Ohio is a big battleground state, so he's in a church. He's speaking, quoting from one of his favorite Bible passages. It comes from the book of James. We'll hear that. We'll also hear from others who are, well, Pat Robertson among them, who are saying, look, the Bible ought to guide our foreign policy. We'll also be hearing from Archbishop Sean O'Malley of Boston, bringing a little, a little bit of reason to the whole question of whether or not the Bible belongs to the left or the right. And we'll also be hearing an entire segment from Dateline NBC Sunday night in their interview with Pastor Rick Warren, author of the book, The Purpose-Driven Life. Open Lines is next. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.